Some good could come of this.
Look, don't start with me about closure.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This, Beverly Hills 90210. Today's episode is Season 10, Episode 18, Eddie Wakis. Yep. All right, here's your host, Tara Ariano and Sarah D. Bunting.
You nailed it. Dave, we also need you to tell our listeners about something very exciting.
Well, you may think, Dave, did you actually record this episode before the campaign even started? No way. This is being recorded almost live and shirt sales are through the roof. There's only 2 weeks left to order your Mad, Bad, and Dangerous to Know, Don't Be Such a Squeef, or Kelly Is a Bitch About It limited time Again With This shirt. All the details you need are at againwiththispodcast.com.
Thank you, Dave. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
Are you ready to talk about Eddie Wakis?
I am not. Let's get it over with anyway.
Well, you're going to have to wait.
I mean, I would talk about actual Eddie Wakis for quite a while, but no one cares. That didn't stop 90210, but here we all are, so let's proceed.
Well, it's going to be a little bit of a wait, Kiss, before we can get to him, because we have two other plots. First, our C plot. Kelly's first PR assignment challenges the principles she may or may not have. So it is Kelly's first day at the PR firm, and I guess she is so desperate to support Matt financially that her strategy for handling this bigoted ballot initiative campaign her new employer is making her run is to talk to Pia when she gets there. And I understand it's hard to maintain perfect ethics in every area of one's life, but if you're working for a company that would take this job, it's not great. Like, that's strike one, really.
Yeah. Well, and I don't know, like the whole, I understand that they need plot lines. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't really understand, like, just everyone jump in the sea, end the show, please. But failing that, like this one.
Yeah.
Really? Her?
Yeah.
Just quit. Yeah. Quit the show. Well, that too.
Yes. So it mostly seems like Kelly discusses this with Donna at this stage of the episode to recap what we learned about the campaign in the last episode about the firm being on the wrong side of the issue of whether public school students should have gay clubs. And also so that we can see Donna in a shirt that literally says baby on it. It's a baby tee with baby on it in like written out in blocks. Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Alphabet
we already
blocks.
Knew.
Yeah. Gross.
So Kelly tries to get some time alone with Pia, who easily puts her off. But then they're together in a meeting about the ballot initiative and the elections in 3 days. Like, why put Kelly on it at all? Presumably there's already been a team working on it. Whatever. Here's where things stand. Clip two.
Okay, people, we are officially screwing up. Eli?
With just 3 days to go before the election, polls show voters equally divided on the proposition.
We've been losing ground ever since the opponents started saying that the initiative was a violation of gay student civil rights.
Isn't that what it is?
I'd like you all to meet our new associate, Kelly Taylor. She still believes in truth in advertising.
The head of the coalition sponsoring the initiative has a big speech planned for tomorrow night. I've already cleared 75 press credentials.
Do you have a copy of the speech?
I got the first draft this morning. It's weak, needs a total rewrite.
Fine. Kelly, I want a new draft by the end of the day.
From me?
Do you have a problem with that?
No.
Good.
So, one of the ways that this story, this plot line structurally tries to be even-handed is whoever the person is that's running the ballot initiative, like the actual backer of it, the person that's giving the speech is completely off screen. Like there's no attempt to, you know, try and make this character seem like anything but a wild-eyed, like crazy bigot. It's
right.
Just, we'll just not actually meet this person so that it seems like there's two sides of this issue, but there aren't really.
Well, no, there aren't. The only thing there's really two sides of is what Kelly should do here. And it's like, you actually had a perfect opportunity to be like, yes, I do have a problem with this. I'm not sure I can work here. Sorry to waste your time.
Yeah.
But so, Kelly, part of it really seems like Kelly doesn't understand what it means to have a job in your 20s.
Right.
Which is unfortunate that that gets conflated with this. But, mm-hmm. and then, well, we'll get into it.
We will. So Kelly has decided that instead of telling her manager her concerns, she's going to spend her first week at this new job tanking her own performance, as we learn from Pia that the speech she had Kelly write sucks. To be honest, that may be true, even if Kelly had tried to do it well.
Yeah.
But the company was hired to sell a ballot initiative, and the way to do that is to paint the opposition as a bunch of radicals. And Pia can obviously tell what Kelly's opinion of this is, despite Kelly's not actually having said it or, for instance, stated that she had a moral or ethical issue working on it, as Sarah said. So Pia just lectures her about their professional obligation and orders her to redo the speech. And then this happens at the Peach Pit the next day. Clip 3.
Hey, Kel, is it true you're working on an initiative about gay clubs in public high schools?
Unfortunately, yes.
Janet saw the speech on the news last night given by some guy who, you know, was in favor of this initiative, and it really changed her mind.
The guy was reading a speech that I wrote.
Really? Well, congratulations. Changed one vote?
First of all, there's absolutely no way that that cramps writing changed anything.
No.
Except possibly her employment status, because nope. Second of all, way to sell out an off-screen Janet who would never.
Thank you.
Jesus.
I do not believe that in any way.
No.
At all.
Absolutely no way. That it worked on Steve, who is a dolt. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Not
yes.
on Janet.
Yes. Yeah, but they couldn't write it the opposite way, because then Janet would be like, thanks a lot. Now Steve is going to vote for your stupid bigoted bullshit.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. I wish they had.
I know. So Kelly's look as she walks to the polling place with Matt is so bad. She's in this like oatmeal colored sweater dress with a brown coat and then these like the chunkiest, dumpiest, chunk heeled-iest knee-high boots. She looks so bad.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And also just wanted to remind you, this week she's in knee-high boots, whereas last week she was in open-toed sandals at a funeral. So whatever.
Yeah.
But she ruefully repeats that she changed Janet's mind on the issue, and Matt says she should be proud that she's so persuasive, which I guess is not a totally asinine thing for a lawyer to say, given how often he's probably had to argue against his own beliefs, mostly when he's been defending Dylan, but still. But he doesn't say any of that, so his pep talk just sounds stupid in clip 4.
Listen to me. This job, whatever its shortcomings, it's going to challenge you. It will demand you to be creative. That's a good thing.
I want to quit so bad.
And if you do, you know I'm going to support you, but I think you should stay.
Even if I'm being asked to compromise everything I believe in.
Kelly, life is about compromise. You may not like it, but there's no sin in it.
Wrong.
In this case, actually, yeah.
Yeah.
There is.
She's not running a campaign for like a slightly substandard cheese cracker that she thinks is bad. Like, she's effectuating legal political change she knows is wrong. Like, this is there is sin in this. Like, sorry.
Yeah, she's helping to codify discrimination. Yeah, sorry. Indefensible. I mean, so is her hair, but whatever.
Yeah.
And excuse me, what is with the Pride of Hamilton Law getting a these and those accent sometimes? Hey, oh.
Well, he's broke now, so he's more of a man of the people, I guess.
These are blue collar guys. All right. Take it easy, so Karen.
At the office, Pia tells Kelly their side of the initiative is polling better, and while she knows Kelly opposed it personally, being a good publicist means putting your own feelings aside, and Kelly says this, clip 5.
You know, I'm getting married. Someday I'll have a kid. And he could be gay. Like one out of every three gay teenagers, he could maybe try to commit suicide because he feels lonely and isolated and on the fringe. Or we could promote groups and clubs that would make him feel safe and secure and like he's part of something good.
I believe we should do that. You have no argument with me.
No, I think I do. Because you can do a job like this. I can't. I quit.
That telephone sound is a sound you do not hear anymore, but wow, that was memory lane city. Holy cow.
Uh-huh.
I mean, are we supposed to think that Kelly is so great for a belatedly sticking to her principles? Like, whatever, better late than never, that's fine. But the only reason that she even finds this principle using both hands is that someday she might have a kid who might be gay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Nice allyship.
Yeah.
Cat butt face.
Also, the other way that they try to like weasel out of actually really taking a stand with this or making it dramatically interesting is that we don't find out how the vote went. Like, this is the day of the vote. She quits.
Yeah.
We don't know if it won.
No.
But at least she can say that she stuck with it through the actual election. You fucking fascist. Go to hell, Kelly. Boo. I mean, I would be interested to know if like this timed out to be, you know, advocacy for a real ballot initiative that was actually being voted on in real life at the time. But I doubt it. Like, I think this is probably just made up for the purpose of making Kelly look like the office Tina Turner, which she's not.
Yeah, no, she is not.
Moving on to our B plot. What do you know? Donna and David have more problems with partners who aren't each other. So David and Donna are not a couple, but are also both over at the Walsh house together alone to visit Maddie when Janet says she has the perfect guy for Donna. No, it's not Matt. It is the Beats printer. Donna makes a million faces, but she and her exposed midriff are too busy mourning to think about dating right now, she says. When Janet goes to the door, Donna makes a face at David and goes, "A printer?" As if her standards are so high that she only is interested in dating a shiftless failing bar manager or above. Hmm. But anyway, speaking of which, it's Noah at the door, super drunk, with a wild hair to play the pinball machine. And Janet gently tells him Maddie's asleep instead of fuck off. But to be fair to Noah, when you decide to put a pinball machine in your foyer, this is the kind of thing you should expect. Noah ignores both Janet and also Donna when she asks whether he drove there and continues trying to get a game started until David unplugs the machine. And just a comment, because the picture that you caught of him passed out on top of the earthquake machine was so good. Like, this really is Vincent Young in his tiny, tiny lane.
Yeah, like, look, we all have strengths. And some of them are strengthier than others, but him acting drunk, it's very convincing.
Yep. So Donna and David have a polite fight about whose responsibility it is to get Noah out of there. David somehow letting Donna win, even though he and Noah are roommates. Fine. We then find out that instead of taking Noah there, Donna brought him back to her place to sleep it off. Not sure why or how she got him up all of the stairs, given how drunk he was, but Kelly is a bitch about it, not unwarrantedly.
Seriously.
And Donna mumbles that Noah offered his help when Dr. Martin died and she's returning the favor. No, he didn't.
No, he didn't. He stayed home drinking and told people to make excuses for him. These were scenes that we saw. Come on.
Yes.
It was a week ago.
Yeah. And in Showtime, I think it was like yesterday. But anyway. Kelly wants to make sure Donna isn't putting Noah's needs ahead of her own. Then David is back at the Walsh house with Donna. This time, Camille is also there. And David goes to eavesdrop at the door as the two bedroom door as the two of them chat with Janet. They're all petting, I guess, a fur coat. I thought it was a throw at first.
Same.
But this is what David hears. Clip six.
When Steve first gave me one, I couldn't believe how good it felt. Although I have to admit, it was a little smaller than I hoped for. Kelly told me that Brandon tried to give her one once and she wouldn't let him.
The only ones I've ever had are fake.
Oh, come on. You've never had a real one?
Never. It's too politically incorrect to ask a guy to give me one.
Well, and you could save your breath with David, because trust me, he's never going to give you one.
I mean, look. Really? It's this conversation is very weird and like 70s.
Yeah, thank you. Like, clearly the oldest person on staff even came up with this as what they are really talking about when David thinks they're talking about orgasms. Like, I know. This is not a thing that people were doing in the 90s, giving each other fur coats. No. Like, no.
What becomes a legend most? Keeping up with current references? I don't know. I can't believe I could remember that. That was when I was like two. Anyway.
Mm. Yeah. It's very weird. But anyway, then the doorbell rings and Donna says this, clip 7.
Wait, can't I just go out the back door?
Also not what we're really talking about, but that is actually what she said.
Yes. So judging by Donna's panic, it's the printer that Janet has invited by for a chill group hang. David denies to Camille that he was listening to their conversation, and Camille has no idea what he's even talking about. Stuff. So it turns out the printer's name is Irv. He's played by a total Hey, It's That Guy named Greg Cromer.
Irv.
Yep. The same person who came up with that fur coat storyline also and named this guy Irv.
Knight of a Thousand Phylacies.
Thank you. I was about to say that next.
I know. I know you were.
He's played by a total Hey, It's That Guy named Greg Cromer, most recently seen by me as Alicia Reiner's stoner ex on Better Things. He is friendly and has a good attitude about this, complimenting Donna on her bravery, and she admits that she tried to make a break for it when she heard the doorbell, and he counters that he circled the block 3 times, but then indicates dimplefully that he likes what he sees, and Donna confidentially asks Camille if she thinks he wants 2 children or 3, so nice matchmaking, Janet.
Yeah.
And over dinner, there's pleasant banter about Steve submitting a story about an alien autopsy for a Pulitzer. And then David gets up to get the door. It's drunk Noah. Vincent Young makes a series of incredibly stupid drunk faces. And I made it to a triptych that I'm very proud of. It's in the visual aids. Oh. He sarcastically thanks them for the invitation and helps himself to David's seat. Steve politely tries to get Noah to leave, but Noah isn't trying to hear it and starts needling Donna about her date instead of noting how little effort she put into her outfit and hair. Like, seriously, she was more done up the last time she was there just to look at a baby. She's in, like, a hoodie.
Yeah.
But Irv seems to understand the vibe between Noah and Donna, but probably was not expecting this gross explanation. Clip 8.
Did you have a good time tonight?
Yeah, I did.
I did too. I had a really good time. See, Noah's, and he's a good friend. And as you can see, he's going through a really hard time right now.
Hey. It's not polite to whisper at the table.
Hey, you guys, somebody asked me a question.
Hey, Dave, what time is it? Well, she's supposed to be whispering in the scene.
Why is she bothering? He's so wasted. He's not going to be paying any attention anyway. I don't understand anything about anyone's reactions to him.
No.
He doesn't live there. If you answer the door and it's him and he's like, thanks for the invitation, you could be like, I'll call you a cab, wait outside, and close the door in his fucking face.
Yeah. Yeah. And also you would think Irv would be like, well, no one else is treating Noah with kid gloves like you are. I mean, they are not kicking him out, you know, aggressively, but also no one else is trying to make excuses for him the way Donna is. Like, I don't get this backslide except for, you know, plot contrivance purposes of prolonging the time it takes for Donna and David to get back together. But it's still very annoying. Anyway, since Noah's too
with the retcon.
Yeah. Since Noah's too far gone to excuse himself and Irv's hosts are too chicken shit to kick Noah out, there's nothing for it but for Irv to tell Donna he'll call her tomorrow and give his gracious apologies on his way out. And even after that, no one yells at Noah and it is stupid.
Yeah, seriously.
The next day, David finds Steve and Matt to tell them his stuffy situation. He had planned to fuck Camille that night, but now he has it on good authority that she can't be satisfied. And his idiot guy friends extrapolate that if David knows this going in, as it were, then if she claims she was satisfied, she's lying and is probably great at faking it. Note, David doesn't add the part where Donna, as far as he knows, said he also never got her off.
Yeah.
Just saying. Over Java. Donna tells Janet that she's given Camille a stake in the store. It's also established that David and Camille have only been seeing each other for 2 weeks, so I guess let's cut Noah a little slack since his kidnapping happened like 4 days ago. But Janet reports that Irv was very understanding about the night before and believes that Donna and Noah are just friends, which they're not even really that. But Janet is even a good enough friend not to have described Donna and Noah as codependent, though she could, and I would. Mm. Janet's very confident that things will work out with Donna and Irv, but she's more concerned about whatever the hell is happening between Donna and Noah. And Donna, the doormat, denies that it's anything to be concerned about, and she's just helping a friend who's been through a trauma. And just as a reminder, the last thing we saw with regard to who knew what about Noah was him telling Steve and Dylan not to tell Donna he got kidnapped, as Sarah mentioned earlier. So if she has found out, it happened off screen, which is a weird dramatic decision.
Yeah.
And if she hasn't, I don't know what trauma she's referring to. You know, like, we all know what happened, but we don't know that she knows. It's really weird.
Yeah. I don't know.
Anyway. Donna claims that Noah has recommitted to going back to AA, LOL, and that she'd love it if everyone would
committed.
I mean, he went to the doorway of the meeting that time and then drank and left.
Maybe that's what he recommitted to, because that's how he's acting.
Yeah, seriously. Donna would also love it if everyone would quit nagging her about her concern for and care of Noah. So then David's with Camille at his place on a blanket on the floor in front of the fireplace, but there's not actually a fire. Like, he's lit a bunch of candles, but not a fire. It's also weird. She seems pretty well seduced, but he just looks like he's already given up on trying to bone her, and maybe he should. Clip 9.
My expectations for tonight were incredibly low.
Thor?
Mm-hmm. Donna told me you're a terrible cook.
And that's what your expectations were all about, my cooking?
Yeah, should they be low about something else?
No, not unless Donna said there's something else I couldn't do.
No. I assume you're great at everything.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Which is why my expectations for the rest of the night are incredibly high.
Are they?
Oh, Camille, you're better than this. Like, you're literally better than this entire show. She's very charming. I wish you would just leave and take us with her.
I also have to go. My vagina just closed up, so
yeah.
I need to get to the doctor.
I need to form a club at my high school, for I am now gay.
So apparently Steve off screen gave David all his hottest sex moves, and therefore the next day intends to collect his reward in the form of an extremely filthy recap of David's first time boning Camille. David tries to put Steve off, but says it was successful several times over. So then Steve assumes if it went that well, that Camille actually was faking. Over to the store, where Dawn is trying on a dress that looks like it was made from a backdrop at a Laugh-In, wondering if it's too bubbly. You can see this in the visual aids. The answer is yes.
Oh, the Cleavern. Yeah. It's a lot.
And I refuse to believe Donna doesn't know what items will best suit her in her own store. Like, why she even would reach for that if she thinks it's bad? I don't get it.
Yeah.
But Janet says Irv is a bubbly guy. David comes in looking for Camille and gives Donna a drive-by compliment on the dress that seems primarily focused on the said Cleavern. And he even uses the word bubbly to describe it, which convinces Donna not to wear it. Cringefully for us all, the conversation then takes a turn toward the boudoir in clip 10.
So, you and Camille, we want details.
Camille didn't say anything.
Don't.
Incredible, really. Well, that's not too bad for a guy who couldn't give her the one thing she'd never had now, is it?
What's that?
The thing. Janet, the thing, the one you guys were talking about in your bedroom. Camille said she'd only had fake ones. You said Steve had only given you small ones. Donna said that Camille didn't stand a chance of getting one from me at all. Remember that thing?
We were talking about furs.
Furs?
Yes, Steve had given me a small fur, and Camille had only had fake furs. Up until last night, anyway, apparently.
I mean, you can see why he would not assume that they're talking about furs, because he's not a 75-year-old lady named Dorothy.
No, he's not.
show.
So they're all still standing around discussing fucking furs and not getting the phone at this business, which is when they hear it's Noah calling as he leaves a message. And David and Janet forbid Donna from picking up. Donna spits that it was cruel not to answer, like, you could have. Yeah. Your arms weren't painted on. But Janet thinks Noah's only using his trauma to keep Donna in his life, and David agrees. And Donna thinks she owes Noah her attention because he doesn't have any other friends. Well, yes, but also, why do you think that is?
Yeah. Let's unpack that. Oh, here we are at the bottom of the suitcase. He sucks.
Oh, no. The radio show is back now with Camille, the devoted groupie, in the booth with David. Tonight's topic is the dumbest assumption you've ever made about your significant other. Clip 11.
So you're bored yet?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So bored. The boredest. Quit.
Camille
now.
Can't wait to hear David's listeners' crazy stories. And David tells her he knows a guy who thought he overheard his girlfriend say she'd never had an orgasm. Not that Fox seems to be allowed to use that word.
Yeah, what the hell?
He keeps talking so long that she figures out he means her and what he overheard, and then is horrified as she realizes how many of their mutual friends he's discussed this with.
Yeah, control A. Good job, David.
So, yeah, she's storming out as David gets back on the mic and revives his old MRA persona, which no one missed. Clip 12.
We're back with Bonehead Assumptions. And you know what I'd like to get started with? This classic, telling the truth is a good thing. Here's a nice little hint about being completely honest with your lover. Wait until it becomes necessary. If it doesn't come up, don't bring it up. Silence is golden.
Don't say lover.
So don't say lover.
Don't say anything on an open mic. Don't say anything ever again. Oh, by the way, everybody, the twofer of Buncey's least favorite blocking is back. From David Silver, drinking coffee from a peach pit cup, holding the rim. Ew, rim. Yep. And the pressing fingertips into eyeballs blocking, also back.
Yep.
Nope.
So Irv at the club with Donna picks up on the end of David's advice to ask Donna whether she's ever made any wrong assumptions in relationships, and she bitterly mentions the ways she's been wronged in the past and spits that the better question is whether she's ever made correct assumptions. And Irv is like, oh, okay.
Yeah, awesome second date talk there, Donna. Way to come back from that first one. Cool.
So he asks if she's okay. She claims she is, but he can tell she isn't and moves his chair closer to say it's okay if she's not. She feels bad that she's not happier there with him when he's so great, but she feels like she belongs somewhere else. Noah works at the club, but she doesn't see him, so she's worried. And Irv doesn't hate her, to her question, but he made the wrong assumption about her, which is that she's available, and she doesn't correct him and just says she's sorry. So bye, Irv.
Oh, poor Irv.
Maybe say go by your middle name from now on.
I was really hoping when she was like, yeah, I just feel like I belong somewhere else. I'm like, you do. Stop fucking going to the pee pad already.
Yeah. Honest to God. Build another set. The next day, please. Donna reports to David on how she smoothed things over for him with Camille. But when he asks for more details, she refuses, given the advice he's been giving on the radio. But she's not referring to the hateful spew. Or sorry, given the advice he's giving, but she's not referring to the hateful spew on his radio show. I am. She means him telling Donna she should ignore Noah. And she actually did go over and see Noah the night before after she got rid of Irv and claims he was sober. Don't believe it. Nope. Didn't see it. David disputes the idea that Donna has an obligation to tend to Noah, who she admits has already called her four times that morning. David wants to know how many nice guys she's going to lose before she realizes her level of enmeshment with Noah is nuts. And I hope he's not counting him in there because he's not nice. And
no,
he's a pig. The end of the Camille slash David part of this idiocy comes when she shows up at his place to say she knows he has a lot of friends, but she's a private person. Instead of being grateful that she's talking to him at all, he repeats his anxiety about his performance and then prompts her to say she should tell him it was great, which to her credit, she doesn't. Though not to her credit, she teases him back in a very flirty way and is there in a faux fur with just underwear underneath it. And, you know, she shows it and it's fine, but it's like, this is a Val move. You're not Val.
No, you're not.
At the beach apartment, everyone wakes up in the middle of the night to noises outside. While Kelly calls the cops, Matt takes a bat to go investigate and is in the living room when a window smashes and a clumsy figure falls in. And Matt has hit him in the gut before Donna and Kelly come running out and turn on the light. And Donna has to stop Matt hitting the person again because, duh, it's Noah. And I made a gif of the reactions of like everyone's face staring at Noah on the floor. And it seriously goes around the room. I'm not kidding. 3 times. It's just these ridiculous soap opera reaction faces, like cut things out of the episode. It's fine.
Yeah, it's fine. Like, you're already ending. Don't, if it's a little short and they just have to run a test pattern, what are they going to do? Take you off the air? They're already doing that.
Yeah. Oh, boy. So that's it for the B plot. On to the A plot. Is Dylan's dad dead? Spoiler, no. So while Janet is entertaining David and Donna at the house, Steve is in Dylan's suite watching Rock and Roll Jeopardy. LOL. Very nice period detail.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Steve gets annoyed that Dylan is getting all the answers / questions right and starts flipping around, landing on a news report about an emergency plane landing at LAX. B-roll of the passengers shows what Steve thinks is Jack McKay, Dylan's father, who exploded in season 3. Although it goes by so fast and the TV quality is so poor that it could just as easily be Robert Clohessy, to be honest. Look at the gif that I made. Tell me I'm wrong.
He really did pick up some forehead inches in the intervening years.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. That's a good, good note.
Thank you so much. This is also pre-TiVo and a hotel, so Steve can't just boop it back 8 seconds and pause it. Dylan bitterly exposits for the new viewers, as if there are any, that his dad has been dead for 7 years. Steve knows, but tells Dylan to look. Lucky for them, there's more B-roll, and this shot of Jack McKay's doppelganger is really much clearer. You can see this in the visual aids too. And he isn't trying very hard to hide from the cameras for someone who's supposed to be dead. Like, seriously, not just loitering right behind the on-scene reporter while he does a stand-up at the gate, but making direct eye contact with the camera. You can see this in the visual aids too, as we hear this clip 14.
Tell me that guy's not an exact replica of your father.
No. I mean, can we also talk about in the middle of the clip as you're bracing for the da-na-na-na, because obviously there's like a very faint theremin. Did you hear that? It's like, ooh, it's a ghost. Or is it? Ugh. Or is it it? Or is it? Ooh. Amazing.
It's really a lot.
I mean, terrible, but amazing. I found this entire subplot so delightfully stupid, I have to say.
It really is dumb at every stage, as we will hear.
Not least because Messrs. Taylor and Perry both look completely disgusted that they even have to deal with
it. Yeah, they do. They
really do. That's how I captioned that picture of Jack McKay, like, when your third kid needs braces and you have to pretend that you're... character didn't get smithereened.
Seriously.
Sorry, buddy.
So the recapping continues the next day as Steve and Dylan and Steve's sun damage on his chest, which you can see in the visual aids, wait in some kind of line at the airport to get information about the passengers on the flight. And we hear that in clip 15.
I'm just saying it must have been a huge conspiracy. Local cops, FBI. You said your father blew up right in front of you. Can you imagine planning a stunt like that?
Steve, there was no stunt, all right? There certainly is no conspiracy. My father's dead. What you guys standing at the airport in the afternoon? Because we got nothing better to do.
Relatable. Mm. Except for the airport part.
Yeah.
Hey, buddy.
It's very munchy.
True. Steve goes to a gate agent to ask whether Jack McKay, who died 7 years ago, was flying under his own name just now. I mean...
Not how you ask for these things. I mean, not that anyone's going to give you the information, but if they were, start with a Benjamin and then maybe have some less insane sounding information to share.
Right. Well, he doesn't say that Jack was dead, but he also doesn't think would it logically be the case that he would fly under his real name? But whatever. The gate agent says he can't give out any information. So Steve presses, saying that Jack is Dylan's father and Dylan hasn't seen him in 7 years. Still no on information. And Dylan is as big an idiot as Steve, but much ruder in clip 16.
Well, if you can't help, what are you doing back there? I'll tell you what you do. Push those buttons, look on that screen, and tell me whether the guy in that plane is my dad or not.
He gets a next, please, which I'm sure they wanted to do a bye-bye, and they were talked out of it by standards and practices. But my note on this was, do you ever get the feeling Dylan's food gets spat in a lot?
Uh-huh.
Because I'm pretty sure it does.
Yep. So that night, Dylan drinks and watches the videotape of obviously alive Jack McKay that he has acquired somehow. And the next day, Dylan, for some reason, makes Steve drive him to his storage unit so he can look up the contact info for Jack's ex-fiance / FBI agent, Christine Pettit, though we're supposed to think Dylan has forgotten her last name. If I haven't, you haven't. Your dad was going to marry her. I'm just saying.
Maybe heroin killed that brain cell?
Perhaps.
Exposition heroin, that is.
This brain trust has somehow convinced themselves that Jack and Christine's relationship was also fake and part of a whole scheme involving Jack giving evidence against Tony Marchette and then going off the grid. And while the rest of that makes sense, sort of, we have no reason to think that Camille and Jack weren't actually in love based on what we knew. But when he goes to open the unit, Dylan sees that the lock has been broken and someone has ransacked all of the boxes of papers, like way more papers than I would ever believe Dylan cared to keep. But to Steve's question, Dylan thinks that what they didn't want him to find was Christine's last name, which, again, it would be reasonable to assume he would remember.
Yeah. Also, just go to the field office then. Like, there's ways to get this information if you were a, like, whatever, not corresponding witness. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, yeah. Anyway. He does manage to come up with it on his own, because then we see him showing up at the good old federal building to ask for Christine Pettit. The receptionist tells him he can't just roll in without an appointment, but he orders her to tell Christine that Jack McKay's son is there. And apparently Jack's alivitude is the worst kept secret in the Justice Department, because even this fucking receptionist knows what that means and gets on the phone immediately. And Christine comes out like 1 second later and looks amazing. She looks so good.
Yeah, she looks like the same.
She looks better than she did 7 years ago. Like, this woman was obviously a very beautiful actress, but like, her skin, it's amazing.
Yeah, and they toned down her color narrative on her blondness a little bit in a way that I think is good. Just to skip back to the storage unit for a second.
Right.
Hey, thieves on TV, if you're looking for papers and you don't find them, put the papers that you don't need back.
Yeah.
It's an idea.
God.
Less likely to leave evidence behind. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, the storage unit should not, or whatever you ransacked, don't ransack it. It should not look like my office when you're done. Good rule of thumb.
Yes. All right. So back to the field office. Dylan may be so stunned by the fact that Christine looks better than she did when he first knew her that he doesn't think not to blurt, "He's alive, isn't he?" in the reception area. But Christine just ushers him back to try to sell him a bunch of bullshit in clip 17.
Your father died 7 years ago, Dylan.
Well, then showing up on the news a couple of nights ago, that was a pretty good trick. Here you go. It's all queued up and ready. This is how you reward the good guys. Fake their death, take them away from their families.
Nothing was faked.
You know, I went to look through his things this morning. The storage facility had been burglarized. Of course, you probably know all about that.
No, I don't know anything about it at all. But I'll look into it.
You said you loved my dad.
I did. And if you were alive, I'd still be with him. But he's not. And life goes on.
Like, he, what has happened in that scene is he has clocked a picture on her credenza of her with a guy and some kids, like, presumably, you know, her family. And is, I guess, using that against her, like, as evidence that she's never loved his dad. Like, it's been 7 years.
Yeah. Also, your wife died and you went to England and loved and lived with Brenda for several years. Even though the show is not going to acknowledge that, I have not forgotten.
Thank you. So Dylan goes back to see Christine the next day, where she confirms what we all should have known this whole time. The name Jack McKay wasn't on the passenger list. Why would it be? Why would he continue using his old name? Jesus Christ. Even Dylan has finally figured this out and demands to know what name they gave Jack when he went into witness protection. Christine has also found out that there was a break-in at the storage facility 3 weeks ago and that several units were vandalized. Someone named Edgar Ramirez has been caught, prosecuted, and is already serving his sentence.
Oh.
3 weeks, guys.
Sure.
Pretty speedy process. Dylan has been doing a lot of thinking about that explosion lately, also, as we hear in clip 18.
I never actually saw my dad get in that car. After the explosion, I never saw a body. There was no open casket, no dental records, nothing.
And there's nothing now. Look, Dylan, I've gone the extra yard for you here out of respect for you and affection for your father. You may not be able to appreciate this, but doing that has opened up some emotional wounds for me as well.
Yeah, you're breaking my heart.
And I found
Fuck
nothing.
You.
And neither will you. So stop looking.
Fuck off, Dylan.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
And also stop coming around here to give me orders like I work for you. Fuck off. You're breaking my heart. Eat a dick.
Yeah. Also, just a reminder that when Dylan's dad died, quote unquote, like they had been on speaking terms for like a month. And prior to that, he like just did not speak to him at all and thought he was bullshit.
Yeah, except when he was like, whatever, yelling at Dylan and then on dates with Brenda. And then he was breaking planters while wearing an acid wash duster. But that was the sum total of their relationship. So
right. And played by a different actor.
Yeah.
One of two other different actors before Josh Taylor came along. Anyway. Dylan is straightening up his storage unit when Kelly shows up to offer to help clean things up, and he melodramatically points her to the bad memory pile, which is big, and the good memory pile, which is nothing. Like, okay, dude, get it.
Yeah, which is it? Like, why are you so sad that, you know, like, just keep thinking he's dead. He hasn't called you, so let it go.
Right. So Dylan claims to believe that the guy on the phone was a very close lookalike. The guy on the plane was a very close lookalike and that the break-in was random. And Kelly suggests without much force that something good could come of this, but Dylan doesn't want to talk about closure. She suggests reflection, sizing up what's been going on in his life for the past 7 years. He says nothing and she says she knows, but like his last trauma was his wife's accidental murder and that was 4 years ago, but okay. Like, again, the show forgets the bad things that have happened to him. And they even mentioned Tony Marchette in this episode.
Yeah.
Anyway, the older Dylan gets, the worse he feels. So when he reflects on his life, he just gets more miserable and misses his dad. And he puts a framed photo of little Dylan and Jack on a shelf, like maybe take that back with you and put it where you live instead of leaving it in this unit to be looked at by no one. Whatever.
Look, a whole other set of thieves is going to come in and they'd like to do something while they're just dumping shit willy-nilly on the floor instead of refiling it.
Yeah. So Kelly doesn't try to argue him out of his feelings and just hugs him for once, which is nice. And Dylan is watching his video again and leaves the image of Jack paused on screen to go open the door where Kelly's on the other side. She sees the screen and says it's unbelievable before immediately changing the subject to dinner. He takes the tape out of the VCR and hands it to her, telling her to get rid of it. And she then says what she maybe should have led with in clip 13.
The company that I used to work for did PR for the airline this guy was on. Before I quit, I called them and I got a copy of the passenger list. We both know that that's not your dad on this tape. And we both know it's not a good idea to keep looking for something you're never gonna find. But Steve told me about the runaround that you've been getting. So, I know I shouldn't be doing this, but here you go.
If... Knowing him is such a trial. Just stay away from him.
Honestly.
She's such a hag.
Yeah. So he actually does have the grace to ask about her saying that she quit, but we've already been over that in our C-plot. You remember. He's not interested in going for dinner, but he does thank her for the manifest. This would be much more useful in our day And you could just check every name against social media and figure out which man's looks the fakest or who doesn't have a social media presence at all. Just saying. Catfish. Anyway, Steve comes by Dylan's in the middle of the night, having been awakened by Maddie and apparently assuming Dylan would probably still be up. He comments that Donna keeps thinking she sees her dad, even though she knows he's dead. Like, hint. But also, that stands to reason. Donna's dad died like the day before yesterday. Dylan denies that he's haunted and reminds Steve about the whole conspiracy theory he was promulgating when they first went to the storage unit. Steve regrets saying any of that if it got Dylan's hopes up, but Dylan remembers an actual show event, singing Take Me Out to the Ball Game with his dad.
Oh, God.
He had forgotten how much they connected through baseball, as we hear in clip 19.
We go to games and we read stories about it. Our favorite being The Natural.
Oh, yeah, I saw the movie with Robert Redford.
Story of a young man full of promise who gets shot by a woman, disappears, and then suddenly returns. Did I mention I got the passenger list?
No. How'd you get that?
Airline's a client of Kelly's or something. Anyway, that book is loosely based on a true story about a guy who played for Philadelphia in the 1940s.
Yeah, Roy Hobbs. Forget about the story. What about the list?
When the team was in a Chicago hotel, he went to this woman's room. She shot him. He battled for his life for a long time before coming back to play the following season.
Is your father on the list or not?
In the book, the guy's name was Roy Hobbs. But in real life, his name was Eddie Waitkiss. That's Waitkiss with a W.
He shows him the list, and there's an Eddie Waitkiss on it.
I know it is.
Do you want to talk about Eddie Waitkiss, Sarah?
Not really. There was something substantively incorrect in the summary that Dylan gave. Okay. It is pretty interesting. Like, it just takes him forever to get it out, though. Like, if you already know this and you've seen The Natural a million times and you've read the book and you just know who Eddie Waitkiss is, I thought it would have been more interesting to use Jimmy Pearsall, who had a sort of very public nervous breakdown in which, like, he was continuing to play and like acting relatively normal, but he just completely lost 4 months of time, like woke up in a hospital.
Oh, geez.
And was like, oh yeah, I guess I was feeling a little woozy after the game last night. And then he looks outside and there's snow on the ground and he's like, oh, anyway, but also sort of like got lost and had to find his way back. But this was interesting, a little laborious, but for this show, at least, you know, correct.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess we'll find out how much of that name choice was supposed to be a hint so that Dylan would find him eventually, or just a lack of imagination. Like, you couldn't have just made it Teddy Waitkiss to cover more. I mean, this is
I guess we'll see. This is like, this is definitely the kind of like baseball-y clue that if I was trying to like avoid other people but let my parents know that it was me, that I would pick something like this. But yeah, I mean, for this show, this is actually a relatively elegant callback, given how horribly Brenda has been treated by the show Bible.
Yeah, I mean, it's of all of the things to bring back, like Dylan's exploded dad is such a weird choice for the final season, but I'm sure we will have much more to say about it in the coming weeks, or at least week.
The little tailors need headgear. Let's just get through this.
For now, let us close up by naming our episode MVP. I'm going to say the gate agent that comes just short of telling Dylan to fuck off.
Irv, for being like, Irv, look, I tried, but fuck this.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's cute. Nice dimples. Least valuable player. Drunk Noah.
Janet. So annoying.
Janet.
All right, don't encourage or like abet Donna's stuff.
Yeah.
don't accept furs from your husband. Mm. I mean, unless they're like vintage or secondhand, I guess that's fine.
Sure.
But also, I don't know, buy your own. You run the beat. We all know it. Don't just allow drunk people to come in and be playing pinball when it could wake up your baby, because that's a nightmare for everyone.
Yeah.
And don't change your vote to a homophobic one based on the convincing writing of Kelly. Sorry. And her hair looks super cute, so this pains me. But Janet, nope. LVP.
That's an excellent case. Well argued. Mm. Let's do the Kim challenge.
Bad, bad, and dangerous to me.
Five ways from this episode, Dylan proves he is mad, bad, and dangerous to know. He's sure mad at the gate agent I mentioned.
Yeah, that's bad. That's going to get you on the no-fly list. Also, using that tone with Special Agent Pettit, not okay. It's bad and probably dangerous.
And probably dangerous to also implicate a poor receptionist at the FBI office in whatever cover-up you think is going on.
Seriously, now she has to go in witness protection. It's bad to visit your apparently extremely important storage facility so infrequently that you didn't realize it had been burgled for weeks. Also, get a better storage facility. They should have called you.
Yeah. It's bad to see Christine and not compliment how great she looks, because it really is stunning. And that makes five.
It sure does. Next time on Again With This Melrose Place edition, it's time for a storyline about Jane's pregnancy. Just kidding. She and Michael are actually embroiled in some matchmaking stuff around Jake and Sandy, while Billy dates an older woman who used to be just one of the guys. Mm. And if you thought the outfits in that movie were bad, wait until you get a load of our visual aids for this and every other episode of Again With This. You can find those on our website, againwiththispodcast.com. And some of them show up on our Twitter account. That's at AWT90210. You can ransack our storage unit for extra content by visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/againwiththis. I'm labored baseball reference Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. My co-host is Fun Fur Misunderstanding, Tara Ariano, and she's on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And our producer is pinball wizard David T. Cole. Talk to you next time.
Hi, you know what to do after the beeparoonie.